call to order the House Committee on Human Services on today, April 20th, 2009. Colleagues, we have several bills on which we don't have fiscal, so we will be carrying over House Bill 2134, 3471, 2137, 2051, 3353, 2868, 3065, and 2726. And if anybody has any direct contact with legislative fiscal, let me
Madam
know.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Maurer.
They don't have a backside.
They don't have a backside.
It doesn't matter. We carried them all over anyway.
Oh. Yes. I'll tell you what they were. Representative, I'll say them again.
Okay. No, you don't have
no,
to.
No,
no,
don't.
Okay.
Are we adjourned then, Madam Chair?
Why are we here?
Yeah, I know.
We have two bills.
We have two bills we will be having public hearings and work sessions on. And the first one will be, let's see, what is that? 3278, I believe. The first bill we will have a hearing on is, and I will open up the hearing, on House Bill 3278. Oh, he's not here.
He went to vote. He'll be right back. We can stand at ease for just a couple of minutes to wait for him to come back. Or
well, do we have, how many people do we have?
I don't know. Let me
pull
the list here.
Okay.
Yep, Madam Chair, just to kind of slow time down and everything, it's nice to see everybody here this morning. And I love Mondays. I wish every day was a Monday. You know,
the Oregonian?
I thought every day was a Monday.
Yeah, in this building it has been.
My goodness.
He'll fix it.
Okay, we will open up the public hearing on House Bill 3273. Keeley?
This bill requires the Department of Human Services to contract with local providers of victim services for the location of staff members at DHS offices for the purpose of fostering a closer working relationship between child welfare and victim service providers. Requires the staff to provide case reviews and coordination and consultation and make referrals of cases closed to assessment. There is a recommended amendment, and that amendment makes the language permissive rather than declarative.
Okay. Sybil Hebb and Cindy Nimmett, thank you, and Reagan Gray.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb here from the Oregon Law Center today in support of House Bill 3273. Very much appreciate the committee's time and attention to addressing the issue of domestic violence as it relates to child welfare cases, and wanted to let you know that the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women joins me in the support of this proposal before you. Drafted during a different economic time, it was initially proposed to be mandatory language. The amendment, as Ms. West explained, would make the language permissive rather than mandatory. We would like to move forward with the bill because it sets forward a good policy that has been widely recognized by local as well as national experts as being the best practice in addressing domestic violence cases when they come to the child welfare system. And I wanted to give you a little bit of background about that issue and then explain to you the policy and the proposal that is embodied in the bill. Generally speaking, unfortunately, domestic violence is one of the most complicated and concerning issues that are facing families who are entering the child welfare system today. The needs of families facing these dynamics are complex and are very intense, and the ability of caseworkers whose mandatory and appropriate initial and principal focus is on the needs of the child does not allow them to look at specifically how to meet the needs of the adult victim who may be facing safety threats. And so the proposal that is embodied in the bill is to provide domestic violence advocates who have specialized expertise in providing safety planning and support to victims of domestic violence to have those people staffed and available at the child welfare offices so that when families in crisis come in to those offices, they are available to provide provide immediate support and immediate assistance, often speeding up the ability of the caseworkers and the child welfare system to more quickly and safely return children to their homes. I wanted to give you a little bit of a perspective on why we're so concerned about domestic violence in child welfare cases and let you know that the co-occurrence of domestic violence in child welfare cases is up to 60%. National statistics show 30 to 60% co-occurrence. That is reflected in local statistics here in both Lane County and Multnomah County. We have seen 55% and 33% co-occurrence rates, respectively. We know that in Oregon, 15% of children are in homes where there is domestic violence present. And of the cases that come to child welfare that become founded cases and require intervention, domestic violence is one of the top three reasons that the intervention is necessary. Substance abuse and mental illness are the other two. And so we have, as a state, recognized the importance of providing specialized services to address substance abuse and mental illness, and we'd like the state and have appreciated the efforts of the department in the past to recognize that domestic violence also requires specialized and intensive services. Otherwise, we miss opportunities to really provide the best help possible and to return children safely to their homes or hopefully keep them there in the first place and prevent having to have a traumatic removal. The other concern that we have about domestic violence, other than its prevalence, is that it has such wide-ranging negative ramifications for children and for families. Domestic violence in the home leads to cognitive and physical concerns, it leads to emotional and social adaptation concerns, and it leads to greater threats of serious physical injury. In Oregon, we know that over a five-year period, there were children witnessing one-third of domestic violence homicides in the state, and there were 8% of those cases, there were children who were killed as well. And so domestic violence can, in certain circumstances, quickly escalate into fatal instances, and so intervention early and often is a principle that we want to apply to these cases. We want to make sure that the intervention is specifically focused on that issue so that it's as effective as possible. We know that when the dynamic of domestic violence is quickly addressed and identified, then we can provide services that are that help adult victims get to safety and resolve that violent threat in a way that prevents the intervention, the state from having to intervene in some circumstances and or reduces the length and level of intervention that's necessary. The service model that we propose, initially proposed under the bill to be provided in every office across the state, but that we would like to solidify in the bill with the amendments as a good policy for the state to be implemented as possible as funding becomes available, would require that domestic violence advocates who have specialized safety planning training are staffed at the child welfare offices in ratios sufficient that they can handle and address the number of cases that are coming before them. And that provides two primary purposes. One is that they're able, at that point of crisis, to take advantage of that intervention opportunity and provide immediate services to victims who may be in desperate need of a place to stay, and just finding, getting them help so that they can have a place to stay may mean that the child is safe and not have to be removed. But oftentimes victims have been unaware of community resources, have not been connected to service providers before, and their intervention opportunity at the child welfare office may be the first time that they've had the opportunity to get any help. And so taking advantage of that moment and getting services to them at that point can make a big difference. The other reason that it's important to have advocates there in the offices is that they can provide consultation and support to child welfare caseworkers who are struggling to identify what are the issues that these families are facing. Is there potential domestic violence? And if so, how do I address that? What's the best way for me to look at this issue within the context of my case plan so that I can make sure that what I'm asking of parents and what I'm trying to provide and help parents is appropriate and has that safety aspect at the background. And so having advocates at the child welfare offices provides those two dual functions. One is services to the survivors immediately, and the other is support to caseworkers as they move through their work. aspect, this proposal has been identified both locally and nationally as a best practice. As you are all aware, our most recent federal Child and Family Services review highlighted at several junctures places where we were missing opportunities, not for want of trying, but we were missing opportunities to provide services to families, and that review specifically identified domestic violence services for survivors as one particular place that we were missing an opportunity. As a result of that review, the governor and the Department of Human Services convened a child safety work group of local experts to look at how can we reduce the need for foster care in Oregon and how can we improve our response to children entering the child welfare system. That group released recommendations in January of 2009, and this service model was one of those recommendations in recognition of the fact that we need to provide these specialized services. As well, the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, which is sort of the nationally acknowledged expert in this arena of child welfare and domestic violence, has recognized this method of service provision as being the most effective way to help kids get safe and help violence issues get resolved. Oregon has been looking at this issue for a long time, and the Department of Human Services has been remarkable in its support of efforts to try to have this, to try to find funds to provide these services in their offices. And they have in the past been recipients of a number of grants. So we have piloted this project in Oregon in rural as well as urban counties and have been really pleased with the success that we have found. And we have heard from women survivors who have been parents in the system who have commented on the ability, their ability to more quickly resolve their safety concerns because of the advocacy that they received at the Department of Human Services. We've also heard comments from domestic violence advocates as well as child welfare caseworkers that this method of cooperation and collaboration has really improved the levels of practice in both arenas and has helped them work together better for families. So we've seen that not only rurally as well as urbanly, is that a word, in an urban context. And so we think that it's a tried and true method. Unfortunately, the funding that had been secured has all expired with the exception of one continuing program in Gresham. The Multnomah County has been a current recipient of a federal Safe Start grant, and there are people from the Safe Start grant who are here to tell you a little bit about their specific circumstances, but that grant's going to expire this coming year. So we are hopeful that with the passage of this bill and its amendments, we solidify the support for the policy and that best practice, and that as hopefully as funds may become available in the future, we may be able to preserve the availability of those services or provide them in more offices as we move forward. I think that draws my comments to a close. I would just offer that, again, we just very much appreciate the attention of the committee to this issue. I do think that as we testified before this committee during the interim back in almost a year ago in May, and there were a number of questions about sort of the number of co-occurring problems that families struggle with as they enter the child welfare system. And I think that the state has done a really remarkable job of trying to find creative ways to provide specific services to families. Struggling parents who are struggling with drug abuse or with mental illness or with domestic violence, often they have really strong and important bonds with their children, and that violence or that illness or that drug substance abuse is what's keeping them from being able to successfully move forward in developing those bonds. And to the extent that the state can provide services to address those issues so that parents and children can be together, we're all much more successful for families as well as for parents. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Sybil. And I want to point out that this bill is on the list of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, one of the prime bills that we're trying to encourage through the legislature this session. So any quick questions of Sybil, or should we hear? Yes.
Actually, Madam Chair, if I might, since based on what you just said, was there a lot of reaching out to domestic violence advocates around the state to help craft this concept?
Let's ask Ms. Hemp.
Okay. Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman, thank you very much for that question, and the answer is yes. The Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women is a grassroots network of all of the domestic violence and sexual assault service programs throughout the state, and we have, as a group, worked closely with the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance in the past, and we every year decide what our priorities are for the benefit of survivors, and this is one of those priorities, and this concept is wholeheartedly supported by the network of advocates across the state. And I think it's for the very reason that they understand that their clients, when going through child welfare, are struggling with so many issues, and if they don't have that safety planning and safety assistance, they're often the lack of safety planning and assistance can become a barrier to mothers, generally speaking, staying with their children in ways that is it's beneficial to resolve that. So the domestic violence advocates across the state are supportive, and they were very much involved in the drafting of the language. So thank you for the question.
Follow-up? I'm concerned about one thing, because I know I've been involved in many, many fundraisers for domestic violence groups, and if they were to have to staff the DHS office, they couldn't do it in my area, I know.
And Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman, and that's exactly right. There are ways in which individual organizations have been able to find funding to allow them to do that, but generally speaking, they cannot, which is why the proposal was to provide mandatory funding so that this resource could be available. So we would love down the line to have that be a statewide general fund policy, that the agency has these resources to provide this, to contract essentially with the local services providers to have that resource available in those offices, because they're unable to do it without that additional assistance. But the language of the bill has been drafted so that it's permissive, and we hope that we can work together with the department and with other organizations to try to find places where there is funding. If we're able to do that, then we can look to the bill to sort of say, here's how this model should work. And the bill sets out that advocates, if they're placed there, if there is funding, that they provide in-depth safety planning for victims. They also provide coordination and consultation with caseworkers, and they do coordination with the other drug and alcohol recovery teams so that there's sort of a coordinated effort to provide help for survivors. And the bill also provides that the department, in implementing a position, should it find funding, coordinate with local victim service providers to set up what the policies and protocols will be around how that works. So it's meant to be a joint effort, but I think we all recognize that without funding, it won't be able to move forward.
Madam Chair, do we have a date for a work session on this? I assume we do, since...
It's on the agenda for today, but we can open it and talk about additional issues if you want to, or we can carry it over and when we have the fiscal.
It's so difficult to have a date certain because we don't know when we'll get the fiscal back.
Okay.
So.
I just wanted to know for sure, because I have one specific provider that I would want to reach out to, because I know there has been difficulties between the relationship between them and DHS, and I really want to get more details on their story.
Great. We'd like that. Okay, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Civil, yeah. On your fact sheet that you provided us, I'm interested in the second bullet that you have. Research shows that there's a correlation between domestic violence and child fatalities. That research, was that from here in the state, or is that national?
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, there is national data on that issue, and then locally in Oregon, what we see is that, I'm going to make sure I get it right, it's 8% of domestic violence homicides result in the homicide also of a child, and that over a five-year period in Oregon, children witnessed one-third of domestic violence homicides. So there's a connection in that they witness as well as that they unfortunately often or killed themselves.
Can't follow up then.
Yeah,
sure.
Follow up.
Well, years ago, the legislature enacted a bill on the Class C felony issue for, you know, domestic violence being, you know, conducted in front of a child.
Yes.
Has that had any impact?
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, I don't know if there are any statistics that show that that has had an impact on a reduction on child fatalities. I do think, from my experience working with these cases and working with survivors, I have seen that that has had an impact on the way that the justice system has responded to domestic violence in the home. And I think that that's had, it's helped other responders also recognize the severity of this circumstance, but I don't know whether there's been any correlation between fatalities or not. There's also a bill that the House Judiciary Committee passed two sessions ago, I believe, it may have been 2005, I can't remember, that allows communities to do fatality reviews when there is a domestic violence homicide of a child or of any individual who's killed as a result of domestic violence. And we're hopeful that as those fatality reviews get convened, that we will learn more about where our opportunities are. And if I may also respond to one more response that Representative Huffman made, I would offer that I think that the opportunities that are provided by having advocates co-located at child welfare offices, one of the great benefits that we've found in looking in hearing from caseworkers as well as from domestic violence advocates is that that cooperation, that collaboration has really helped to resolve some of the institutionalized, in some communities, sometimes a suspicion, for lack of a better word, between agencies about ways to resolve domestic violence. And so I think that that's one of the goals of this proposal is that we can learn from one another about the ways in which we can effectively respond, and that's been the feedback that we've gotten from people who've participated in those in those grant projects in the past. So.
Just quickly, one of my concerns, and I've visited with Mickey about this, is as we're trying to assure the safety of children and trying to help most often women, it's not necessarily just women, but most often women, as we're reaching out and trying to help them, sometimes we're killing them with all of the requirements of classes, and they can't even keep jobs because of all the classes that we're trying to help them with, you know, and so we're suffocating them with mandates. And so as we proceed, I'm always going to be trying to find a balance so that we're not killing the people we're trying to help.
Thank you, Representative. We're going to go on with our testifiers here, and then we can open for more questions.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Reagan Gray, for the record. I'm a policy analyst with Children First for Oregon. And Children First's mission is to ensure that Oregon, all Oregon children, are able to thrive. We have almost 10,000 Oregon kids that are in foster care on a daily basis. And while foster care addresses the immediate safety needs of the child, the experience of foster care can increase a child's risk for future problems in the area of education, employment, and mental health. By offering the domestic violence services at the child welfare offices, families can address the immediate safety needs and ensure children can return home quickly, safely. And by addressing the issues that put families at crisis, we can tackle the child safety issues on the front end and produce better outcomes and really save a lot in costs, because putting a child into foster care costs a lot of money and following them through the system. So having a domestic violence advocate stationed there at the child welfare office, being able to address those immediate safety needs of the child and the mother or other parent, will really help in cost savings and help with children's outcomes as well. So Children First absolutely supports this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Reagan. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. Chair Tomei and committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak this morning in support of House Bill 3273. I'm Cindy Nemet, and for the past 12 years, I've had the opportunity to assist those escaping domestic violence and sexual assault. In this capacity, I've been a caseworker at a shelter. I've run a supervised visitation program, and currently I am the legal and rural advocate at Clackamas Women's Services. CWS is the only agency in Clackamas County that provides services specifically for domestic and sexual abuse survivors and their families. I was also, prior to this position, the CWS Family Violence Specialist outstationed at the Oregon City and formerly Milwaukee, later transitioned into North Clackamas branches of the Department of Human Services, in which I provided domestic violence advocacy services to survivors of domestic violence and their children, referred to the Clackamas County Child Welfare Offices. It's my experiences and observations during my tenure there that I wish to talk about today. It will not come as a surprise to anyone present, the vast number of reports that come in daily to DHS Child Welfare Hotline. Family members, friends, neighbors, teachers, counselors, law enforcement, and medical personnel. Some are mandated reporters and others not. While the majority of these calls are in concern for the child or children, a small number may be generated as retribution or for the purpose of intimidating or coercing a former partner. Of these volumes, decisions are made to appropriate actions. A report may be closed on screening or designated to be investigated within a 5-day period, or in the most urgent cases, within 24 hours. On the average in my position, I was referred about 20 to 30 clients per month from these sources and others, each identified as challenged with domestic violence issues. I want to talk about one client that I worked with. I'll refer to her as Jane. She was one of those, and she was referred during a closing of an investigation. Although this was the first report by any source of the family, the investigation revealed that the report was unfounded. The assigned caseworker assessed that Jane was in need of further support and referred her to me. We began meeting weekly, but it wasn't until a month had passed that she one day disclosed an incident to me that had taken place more than 5 years before. Late one evening, she reported she was in a passenger in a car driven by her ex-husband. Her infant son was in the back of the car in his car seat. Without provocation, he grabbed her by the back of the head, slamming her head into the gear shift of the car. This broke her glasses and her nose. She bloodied and unable to see, begged him only to allow her to get her son from the back seat of the car after he had made her get out on the roadway. Her pleading intensified, and he finally relented to allow her back into the car and drive her to the hospital only if she would not report to authorities the abuse that had happened. During the whole time in the emergency room, he sat next to her, keeping his lap. She was so fearful that she kept the secret then and never told anyone about the abuse. And although she had separated pretty soon after that event, she still attempted to facilitate visitations between her son and his father, constantly in fear that if she didn't, the danger would be even greater. More than 5 years later, her fear was still as intense as it was on that day. The months after her disclosure to me were spent in safety planning with her and her son. Resources and referrals were given, parenting classes, support groups, legal help for modification of parenting time, and a child's program cell phone. Individual and joint counseling for both her and her son began the healing process. At the end of 8 months, she was well on her way to rebuilding her family's life into ones that were healthy and safe. She never told anyone about the abuse she had suffered because she felt shame and guilt and fear. But by providing her with support in that time of trauma, she was able to develop trust enough to disclose a threat to me that together we were able to resolve. Luckily, because of this intervention of these safety steps and support, Jane's son was able to stay safely at home with her. He didn't have to suffer the additional trauma of removal from a loving parent or the security of his own home. Had this resource not been available to her, the situation likely would have been quite different, and it could have easily escalated into one of physical injury of her son by his father. I can personally attest to the fact that having a family violence specialist physically located in the branches of the Department of Human Services can not only be beneficial to the population that we both serve, but to the child welfare staff themselves as well, providing education and support. Also, the relationships and access that are attainable through proximity not only expedites the utilization of services, but also greatly expands it. Outstationed advocates are only but one part of larger organizations, comprised of specialists in different aspects of the dynamics of domestic violence and sexual assault. Our agency alone allows access to individual and group counseling for adults, children, and teens, as well as housing specialists, legal advocacy, a 24/7 hotline, and shelter. In addition, we network closely with a vast number of community resources, both public and private, that allow us to offer services and basic necessities without any cost to our clients. I wish to thank the members of the committee for their concern for the survivors and their commitment to ending domestic and sexual violence, and again for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Seeing none, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Now we have Annie Neal, Sonia Keck, and Stacey Ayers.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Stacey Ayers. I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding House Bill 3273. And I just received the actual amendment, so I wasn't prepared to discuss really whether there was a fiscal impact or not. The previous form of the bill does, there would have been a fiscal, and although this is clearly a bill that and you know, theoretically the agency would support wholeheartedly, because of the fiscal, we would have had a difficult time coming out in support of that. However, with this amendment, I think it looks and appears that it would remove a fiscal, but we'd have to do a further analysis on that. I would echo everything that Ms. Hepp said, as well as Ms. Nemitz and Children First representative. I think that having advocates co-located in child welfare offices is a great idea. It's something that's been piloted, as Ms. Hepp said, in several of the offices in the state, and it's been very successful. And I think at this point, because most of this has already been covered, and again, I'd be in support, or the department would be in support of that, I'd open it up for questions that you might have of me.
Thank you, Stacey. Any questions? Representative
Dimbro,
and then Representative
Callum. Thank you, Madam Chair. Stacey, I agree. This sounds like a great program, and at some point, hopefully, we'll be at a point where it can actually receive adequate state funding.
Right.
But even before then, do you see any potential problems if there are multiple providers, multiple organizations who would want to be involved in this capacity? How would the agency decide which would be the one to go with?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not sure that I have the actual answer to that. Historically, I know that many of the right now we have currently domestic violence programs throughout the state and individual counties, and so we're working with them. I don't know, and I'm not sure if it's through contact or through a contract or not. I think probably the best thing I'd have to defer. I'm not sure exactly how we would go about identifying who would be the program that we would use. So I'm sorry, I can't answer that right this second.
That's an excellent question, yeah. Representative,
yes.
And we'll try to have the answer by the time we have a work session.
Great, thanks.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm struggling a little bit with how to frame my question. We've recognized that there have been some pilots that are successful. I think my question is there anything in statute at this point in time that would prevent you from placing this particular kind of advocacy in the department's field offices if the money was there to do it?
I don't think that there's anything that prevents that from happening now. If the money was there, if we could adequately fund and staff that, I think that I feel comfortable that is something the agency could entertain. I don't think that there's any statute that prevents that from happening.
President Freeman.
Thank you, Chair. I was going to ask that question and then follow up with, since there is nothing keeping you from doing it already, you guys must kind of internally set your priorities of what the most important thing to do is. Where would this line up in your priorities? So, I mean, if we're taking the funding from something else, what would get cut for this to happen, or how would that work? And why isn't it already being done, I guess, is what I'm trying to get to.
Well, I think that that's a difficult question, but something we go through with. It's not in the governor's recommended budget, and that's something that is the governor sets the budget and the department follows it. And so, you know, I can't say that this has a higher priority than something else that the governor has put in the budget. Every part of, you know, anything that's related to child abuse is a high priority for us. And so I can't say to you, though, that this is a higher priority than another form of child abuse or something that puts children at risk. We think we take this very seriously. We take domestic violence very seriously. We want to have the best practice we possibly can throughout the state. We want to be supportive of anything that is going to help eliminate or diminish in capacity the effects of child abuse. And so, you know, putting on a high level priority, this is a high priority for us. And that's the best way that I can answer that question.
Thank you.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, and everybody's asked all the questions that I have, but I'm still sitting here thinking that can we not do this on an informal basis without having the department pay for this position? It would seem to me that some of these things could happen.
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, and I apologize because I wasn't addressing you appropriately, but I think that Representative Huffman actually kind of spoke a little bit to one of the issues that comes up with this, is that, and I would probably defer to the programs themselves having the capacity to be able to provide a representative from their particular program to the department for whatever basis or whatever time period it would be. I think that that's one of the limitations without having the appropriate funding.
Okay.
But
thank you.
Any further questions? All right, thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and committee members. My name is Annie Neal. I work for Multnomah County in the Domestic Violence Coordinator's Office as the project coordinator for one of 15 federally funded pilot projects. It's funded through the Federal Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention to evaluate promising practices, and this model is one of their top priorities. We are 2.5 years into a 4-year grant project. We have 2 domestic violence advocates and 1 parenting specialist who are located in the Gresham Child Welfare Office. They provide domestic violence emergency services and advocacy consultation to the child welfare workers. And then there's also a parenting component where they provide support to parents who've been traumatized and whose kids have been traumatized around how domestic violence has affected their family. The goals of our project, in addition to providing these services on site, is really to provide the immediate access to services. There are services in the community, but they're Not enough, frankly, to meet the demand. So people looking for help often have to call many phone numbers, get on waiting lists, and really struggle to try to find appropriate services. The ability for child welfare workers to bring a domestic violence advocate into the consultation or to introduce them to the survivor immediately helps them at that point of crisis establish immediate safety and, as Sybil Hebb said, sometimes helps prevent removal. It helps people who maybe, in our experience, who most likely have never been able to find help for domestic violence before. It helps them get connected immediately without having to figure out, how do I find help? What kind of help is available? How would I ask for it? There's someone who's right there who can say, this is what we have to offer you. This is why the child welfare system is concerned for your safety and for the safety of your kids. So by doing that, by helping them provide immediate safety, they're able to create a safe environment for their kids. The improvements that we've seen on the child welfare side, child welfare staff have had training and the opportunity to work with domestic violence specialists, and they've gotten much better at identifying and assessing domestic violence risks and the impact that has on children. Child welfare workers have a really tough job with a lot of demands, and they cannot be experts in everything. So having that on-site resource is really helpful to them. They also have access to information about risk factors related to domestic violence. Their training really focuses on kids, and they have a lot of experience with domestic violence, but domestic violence advocates specialize only in risk factors associated with domestic violence. And they can help access the domestic violence advocates can help access the information about how the rest of the systems respond. Usually, people come into the child welfare system at a point of crisis. They may have had a police report or they may have had a serious assault. And so domestic violence advocates can follow up on what's happening with restraining orders. Was there a police report made? Is the district attorney's office prosecuting? And figure out that information on behalf of the victim while child welfare focuses on the safety needs of the children. As Representative Huffman said, services are limited in the community. The ability for a domestic violence advocate to be available on site really helps with the immediate access. And for agency, for child welfare to have to refer to an agency, it's almost like a cold call, like here's a list of phone numbers. They're not necessarily going to get that immediate response without having people in the building. On the domestic violence side, we've seen access to a better access to understanding how the child welfare system works. It's a really complex system, and it's a very scary system. And historically, domestic violence and child welfare agencies have had sometimes very adversarial relationships based on not really understanding each other's role and not really understanding each other's process. They've been able to really improve how they work together. For domestic violence advocates, they've been better able to support parents so they understand what child welfare expects. They can help parents navigate this really complex system and provide safety for their kids. And they can help parents understand a pretty scary experience and help sort of take some of the fear away from the child welfare system. Parents, I think every parent would react negatively to having child welfare step into your life, even if in the end it turns out to be a benefit to your family. They also can provide home visits and parenting groups that are really specifically tailored to the needs of families where domestic violence has put the kids at risk. And that, as you mentioned also, is one of the really hard things for families involved with child welfare. There are a lot of demands, and there are a lot of services that they try to get people engaged in. And being able to provide home visits or being able to provide a group that specifically addresses the concerns child welfare has is really beneficial. I would say that overall we've really improved our understanding in both sides, domestic violence and child welfare, of these really complex systems. We have much better relationships and trust between the agencies that have resulted from the contact with each other and learning each other's systems and being able to bring people into child welfare staff, into domestic violence agencies to explain their system, and domestic violence staff to child welfare to explain their system. And people have a much better appreciation of the challenges facing each side. We've been able to do a lot with the three staff that we have. We feel really good about the work they've done and the relationships we've established. We have a year and a half left in our grant funding, and we're hopeful that we do not lose the infrastructure that we've built and the relationships and skills that we've built. So thank you for considering this, even during these very difficult times that you're making decisions during.
Thank you, Ms. Neal. Any questions of Ms. Neal before we move on? Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
Hi.
Take it deep.
Thank you for your time. My name is Sonia Keck. I'm a survivor, not only of domestic violence, but the system. In 2006, I came into the child welfare system. Lost, confused, scared to death. Everything that my partner told me would happen, happened. My kids were taken. But I met Nancy from Safe Start, and she helped me navigate the system, get the support that I needed, and find the agencies that I needed to work with. I got all four of my boys into services quickly, myself into parenting and domestic violence support group. I was able to stay safe and to remove my children and myself from a harmful situation. I have sons, and without Nancy and Safe Start, I don't know that they would not be abusive. So I support this bill because it helps, and it really works. It really works to work with a caseworker and a domestic violence advocate, because when you can't get through to your caseworker, you can get through to your advocate, and she can help you. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for coming and telling us your story, Sonia. Sonia, are you in Multnomah County? Is that where you...
I started out in Multnomah County. I am now in Clackamas County. I have been domestically violent-free for 3 years. I'm a full-time college student at Clackamas Community College, studying criminal justice and pre-law.
That's great. Good for you.
Thank you.
So you found the worker regarding domestic violence in Multnomah County,
yes,
at the DHS office.
Yes.
And so your sons were taken away from you, if I'm understanding you correctly.
Mm-hmm.
You became involved with the DV worker.
Yes.
And that person helped you get through the system, it sounds like.
Yes.
And then you were able to get your sons back and move your life,
yes,
on track.
My boys were only gone for 7 months, and now they're all home with me and have been home with me for 2 years.
That's great, Sonia. Thank you so much. Any quick questions of Sonia? We're so happy for you.
Thank you
so much. I'm proud of the work you've done.
Thank you.
Good job. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Thank you very much for coming
Thank
to
you.
Testify today. And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3273.
And carry the work session over to Wednesday.
And carry the work session over until Wednesday. And we'll open up the work session or the public hearing on House Bill 3278.
This bill requires the Department of Human Services to conduct a study of the regulatory oversight of residential treatment facilities for determination of what facilities are subject to oversight by multiple public bodies and a determination of measures to reduce duplication. The recommended amendment allows the operators of residential treatment facilities for children to submit proposals to the Department of Human Services for administrative changes to reduce duplication, improve efficiency, and increase cost savings.
Thank you. Representative Kinnemer, sorry you had to wait.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bill Kinnemer from District 39, and I appreciate very much committee members and Madam Chair the opportunity to talk about my bill, House Bill 3278, and I would direct you to the -1 amendments. This is an interesting bill, and if you'll allow me, I'd like to just share an experience that I think was critical to coming up with this. Shortly after I was elected in November, I received a call asking me to visit the Perry Center, which is a residential treatment facility for children and adolescents. And in the course of that visit, a couple of things began to emerge. They needed money, more money. And they were doing a pretty terrific job. But as we talked about it, we also found that they have seven different regulatory bodies that come in and do inspections, that interact with them and regulate them. And very often, these do not coordinate or cooperate. So if you, you know, and when you're treating troubled children, you're going to have issues come up. And we know that with the state hospital. We know that in residential treatment. And so what happens then is you start working out a compliance agreement with one of these seven agencies, and if you're not careful, the second one starts an investigation, or the agreements that you make to bring you in compliance with that one is seen by the second agency, or third, or fourth, or fifth, or seventh, as taking you out of compliance with them. It just seemed like a conundrum. And as I thought about it a little bit more, I began to realize, and even back in December, we didn't have very much money. You remember the forecast has gotten much bleaker. I started realizing, you know, if we could stop some of this redundancy, maybe we could make a difference. They estimated that 40% of the time of their therapist was spent in charting. And frankly, a lot of that was in self-preservation and protection of the agency, documentation and bureaucracy rather than therapeutic in its nature. And as I thought about that, I thought, wow, if we could reduce that, wouldn't that, that's the same thing as a big increase in money. And that's something we could do in these tight economic times. And then I recalled, you know, some of you know I served in the legislature in the previous century. And I remembered Senator Neil Bryant. We had a conundrum in those days, EPA and DEQ. They would get involved in a problem on a property with environmental restrictions. And the two of them made it almost impossible to get to yes, because one would have a problem and the other wouldn't agree with the same solution, and you would go around and around in a catch-22. And I thought, wow, what a nice... Neil was able to resolve that. Maybe we could do the same kind of thing. So that was the basis for introducing this bill. Then as I introduced the bill, some of the folks from the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs and others came and they said, you know, a study is expensive. That's not very consistent with what you're talking about. Why don't we just open up conversations directly? Because surely the agencies and providers have similar goals. It's hard to get to change, but we all want to be more efficient. And more efficient is the same thing as a cost increase or an increase. And so that's how the Dash 1 amendments have come about. They are a collaborative effort to create a direct way to bring about change and to put it in a formal way and also to bring it back to us so that we know what's going on. Because obviously, these regulatory agencies need to be cooperating and they need to be working. And certainly we want people safe, but we also want them well-treated. And I don't think, as a mental health professional myself, that there's any way you can justify 40% of the time of a therapist being involved in charting. It's not that valuable. It is important. You need to think these things through. So a couple of things about this. I think our current environment has both challenges and opportunities. The challenges are financial. Why don't we change the way we do business a little bit? And let's speed up change and reduce the bureaucracy of it. We know that our children have multiple needs we know that improving access to treatment and increasing treatment is a more effective way to do it. And I think this bill will actually work in that direction. I think all of us that have any involvement in the human resources environment know that we need more money, and people are constantly talking about the costs and the difficulties of regulation and the redundancies. Well, this is an effort to do something, and I think something that will do something about that. And I think another part of it is that providers often have a sense that gets lost among agencies in trying to figure out how to do it. What is our real goal here? What is the goal of charting? Is it to meet regulations, or is it to provide better treatment, or is it some mixture? And maybe having some of those discussions so that we understand clearly what the goals are and get more focused will help all of that occur. I want to thank you for your time. We have a team of other people who wish to speak on this bill. I think it's pretty straightforward, and I think it can make a difference. I saw it happen about 15 years ago with DEQ and EPA. I think we could, you know, if you could reduce that by from 40% to 20% of time, do you realize what a gigantic budget increase that would be at the Perry Center? And you multiply that times the other agencies that we're going to see, we could have a huge increase in productivity without increasing our budget this time, which is probably, well, you all know it's going to be worse than even that. So that's with that. If you have any questions, I'd be delighted. Otherwise, let's move on to testimony.
Representative Kenner for bringing this bill to us. Any quick questions of Representative Kenner? Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you all so much.
So we have Janet Arendt.
Janet Arendt wanted to speak next.
Okay.
Well, if I may, Chair, bring my colleague.
Of course.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and committee members. Thank you very much for this opportunity to hear House Bill 3278. I'd also like to thank Representative Maurer, who's a co-sponsor, along with Representative Shields and Representative Monis Anderson. As you understand from the comments from Representative Kenner, there were some amendments submitted to the bill. We will. We also understand that the statutes that are cited in here regarding the residential facilities are too narrow and not consistent with our intent, which you'll hear reflected in the testimony. And so we will be submitting for a further amendment to make sure that it's broad enough in scope to be able to affect a significant number of providers for children's services. The time is short, so I submitted some written bullet points to you. I just want to touch on a couple of quick points. There is we represent over 350 programs throughout the state of Oregon, and that's over 95,000 children that we serve every year. That creates a labyrinth of challenges for us to be able to navigate through significant numbers of contracts. Morrison Child and Family Services, who is not able to be here today, for example, has 46 different contracts. So that's an astonishing amount of oversight and regulatory issues for them to have to be prepared to address. The executive director there tells me that she's involved in audit every single day of their operation as a result of multiple contracts and oversight. And about 9% of their management staff time is spent specifically on regulatory issues. What we like very much about the bill is that it creates an opportunity for us to be responsible partners and to step up and provide some specific suggestions and recommendations about places where we think that efficiencies could be achieved and redundancies reduced both by the department and by ourselves. The department has no obligation in this legislation to adopt any of these, only to take a look at them and evaluate them and then provide you with some feedback and information on the recommendations and why the decisions were made. So with that, I'd like you to hear directly from some of my members about some of the issues that they're addressing through the bill.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei and committee members, I'm Kim Scott. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Trillium Family Services, and our programs include Perry Center, Children's Farm Home in Corvallis, and Waverly Children's Home, which is also in Portland, not far from the Perry Center. Trillium treats about 5,000 kids a year, and I just want to say that last week marked my 30th year of working with kids and families, and all but five of those years have been with kids in Oregon. I want to underscore the importance of the rules, Oregon administrative rules, that pertains to our services. It's really the bedrock of quality, and the standards are very, very important. So we're not quibbling about that in the least. I think the important part of 3278, though, is that there's a recognition that providers such as myself have a perspective as it relates to the regulatory environment and undergoing a lot of the reviews that are taking place, we have a perspective about certain efficiencies, consolidations, those types of things. As Representative Kinnamer mentioned, we spend a lot of our time working with, depending on the issue, we can have as many as 7 or 8 different entities coming and reviewing the same concern, oftentimes with multiple findings and sometimes with conflictual findings. I think in terms of what is already a very complex environment, adding to that complexity also has an effect on our quality of care, retention in terms of our employees, because a lot of their time is spent, as he mentioned, doing documentation rather than the mission-driven work that they signed up for. So I think the power of this bill is that folks such as myself would be able to have input in terms of how that is that regulatory environment is shaped and organized. Again, not about the rules, but more about the process in which this takes place. And I think 3278 gives us an effective arena to do that. This is not the first time that this issue has come up in the past 5 years. I've talked with the heads of DHS about efficiencies. I think they've all said this is it's a good idea, but as other issues emerge and stuff, this particular issue has typically taken a backseat. So I think that this brings it more into a stronger focus and would provide the environment that we need to be able to get our input regarding this issue. So thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Go ahead.
I'm showing you this one.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting us, and thank you for your service to Oregon's children. Appreciate that very much. My name's Deborah Cather Seymour, and I'm the Executive Director of Chehalem Youth and Family Services, which is in Yamhill County, and I've been serving there for 31 years. The Department of Health and Human Services really does deserve to be commended for working tirelessly with insufficient resources to meet the needs of the state's children. I'm not here to criticize them in that respect at all. I see them really working miracles on a shoestring. That notwithstanding, however, the current economic climate calls for greater creativity and innovation to ensure that the state and its children receive maximum value for every dollar. Blind spots can develop through years of bureaucratic routine and the tyranny of the urgent as the agencies respond to critical issues of child safety. And that's what Kim was referring to in saying these issues end up in the back seat. A forum which focuses on rewarding creative and innovative ideas for increasing system efficiency can produce surprising results. Just such a standard is a requirement of the national accrediting body, the Council on Accreditation. We just completed our accreditation again at Chehalem Youth and Family Services, and we got low marks because we didn't have this forum for creative and innovation reward within our organization. We got high marks everywhere else, but that one we had to do a plan of correction for. When we did it, amazing things started to happen. We began to reward our own employees for creativity and innovation that started to get an amazing energy and efficiency going within our organization. So I'm talking about something I've experienced just recently in an important way. Under current leadership, DHS has created a healthy climate of mutually respectful partnership, which welcomes provider input and healthy communication at DHS-sponsored provider meetings. And I told you I've been around in this system for 31 years. I've seen a lot of administration in DHS come and go. I have to say, there's a nice camaraderie, a nice collaboration in the communication that goes on. So there's no criticism there. This groundwork allows a bill like HB 3278 to now be successful, a successful tool for streamlining expensive bureaucratic redundancies, which have developed over decades prior to the current administration, and which will continue to impede DHS and providers in our common purpose of child welfare. One brief example to highlight the point: CYFS, along with many other providers, underwent an audit of billings for one-on-one care provided for children. In CYFS's case, the audit lasted on and off for over 3 years as auditors changed, as the standards changed. The process, and though professional and thorough, consumed over $10,000 of internal staff time to meticulously document a match of the individual child to a given individual staff, then broken into 15-minute increments, which would also had to be matched to the location of the service and then verified that the needed intervention was actually delivered according to a specific plan for the specific child in question. And by the time all was said and done, an agreeable resolution did occur. But unfortunately, by then, CYFS had spent that $10,000 on the process, which could have been well used elsewhere. Now, precisely how much money DHS spent on that particular audit is unknown. But in the end, clearly, DHS and CYFS paid more than twice what was recovered through the audit. Not a good investment. A simplified alternative is surely possible. Advance notice of audit standards, for example, or flat rates for the job. I'm sure we can combine our creative energies to find solutions for many other quagmires as well, with the supportive direction of HB 3278. At the bottom of my testimony that I've provided you, I've listed four other bullet points of items that I think deserve looking into, places where it's possible that we will find some real efficiency, where we can streamline our processes, and where we can untie, unfetter the programs that are trying so hard to do a good job with kids, but find themselves diverted into so much red tape. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, representatives of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. I am Francis Marr. I'm the executive director at St. Mary's Home for Boys. St. Mary's Home for Boys is a residential day treatment and outpatient mental health facility located in Beaverton, Oregon. We currently contract with the Department of Human Services as well as the Oregon Youth Authority to provide behavioral rehabilitation services to some of the state of Oregon's most severely behaviorally and emotionally disturbed adolescent males. While we are licensed by the Department of Human Services, we receive oversight by multiple agencies, including DHS and OYA. DHS recently completed a statewide mental health organization change that required VRS providers to contract with each child's MHO in the respective county of origin as opposed to their county of residence. This change necessitated that our agency develop contracts with eight additional MHOs throughout the state of Oregon. Each MHO has different billing procedures, rates of reimbursement, authorization requirements, and care coordination procedures. These complexities are further compounded in situations where an MHO provides services for multiple counties in which each county has individual administrative requirements. MHO providers, in turn, are required to establish care coordination and administrative procedures for hundreds of children in dozens of BRS facilities throughout the state. Our agency alone logged over 1,000 administrative hours over an 8-month period in order to assure the continuity of care our children so desperately need. Our agency receives biennial BRS file reviews by DHS and OYA to assess our compliance with contractual requirements. While the BRS contracts with DHS and OYA are virtually identical, they are conducted in a phase as such that our agency undergoes a review by a state agency on an annual basis. This is in addition to our biennial DHS licensing reviews, internal DHS BRS audits, OYA evidence-based correctional program checklist reviews. While these reviews are instrumental in assuring regulatory compliance, program efficacy, and independent validation, that they are abound with opportunities for reciprocal synergies. St. Mary's Home for Boys is committed to providing the highest standards of care in a regulatory environment that embraces transparency, fidelity, integrity, and accountability. House Bill 3278 represents a welcome opportunity for residential treatment providers to collaborate with the Department of Human Services in obtaining greater regulatory efficiencies and cost savings alike. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maher. Any questions of anyone on this panel? Representative Van Orn.
Chair Tomei. Albertina Kerr gave us a matrix a couple of weeks ago, and on that chart, I don't know if you're familiar with that, it was highlighted that there are 14 different agencies, or 14 different inspections, so to speak, or reviews, and out of that 14, 10 were with DHS, and seeing that, from your experience, do you think DHS could possibly integrate those 10?
Representative, we will have somebody from DHS here testifying. Would you rather ask that question of them?
No.
Or you free to ask them?
Well, let me hear from them, and sure. Then we can hear from DHS, too. That would be great. Thanks.
Particularly, the one that jumps off the page at me, Representative Van Orman and Chair Tomei, is the on the mental health side, and as Francis was just talking about on the child welfare reviews versus any time the state comes out to do a certification, we get the, from the mental health perspective, we got our certification from mental health and addictions, and then child welfare arm of DHS also does a licensure review. From a provider perspective, in some ways they are looking at some different things, but the bulk really is about program quality, and we've worked for years to talk with them about consolidating that particular review. There are other reviews that include ongoing reviews with a body that the state contracts with, which is Acumentra, and then OIT. Is another group that comes in to look at quality of care concerns as they relate to seclusion and restraint, those types of issues, and we're wondering what kind of efficiencies might be able to happen between those two groups as well.
Okay, thank you.
Any Madam further questions, Representative?
Thank you. Ms. Seymour, on this, on your short list of other possibilities,
yep. You
say licensing duplication among multiple state agencies. You are accredited with the national organization. What is the name of the
Council on Accreditation?
Madam Chair, several. What do they accredit?
They set national best practice standards. It's similar to JACO, which the two have historically acknowledged one another or. Been very similar. So these national best practices then the organizations try to achieve those standards and then are accredited.
You answer my question.
Okay.
So JACO and this national accreditation
COA, yes.
Are somewhat of the same.
Are very similar.
Okay. Does this accreditation require you to be licensed in the state before you can be accredited?
No, I don't believe that is a requirement because there are 12 states in which accreditation is permitted in those states in lieu of licensure.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? All right, thank you all very much. Now we have Michael Morris from DHS.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be able to testify. I'm Mike Morris with the Department of Human Services. I'm the Quality Improvement and Certification Manager for Addictions and Mental Health. The written testimony that I have provided is in regards to the original bill. I think some of the issues that were identified in that testimony carry over with some exceptions. There was a, towards the end of the written testimony, there was some mention of suggested amendments, and since we have this morning seen the actual amendments, I believe after we go back and do further analysis that the statement regarding expanding the bill and possibly creating a fiscal, I think that will go away. We, at Department of Human Services, as you know, have been involved in a transformation initiative where we're looking for efficiencies, and this is one of the areas that was brought to us. It was brought to us. We recognized it ourselves, but brought to us by providers complaining regarding some particular incidents that were reviewed and the lack of coordination and multiple individuals coming in, and it got drug out for quite a time. And so we have been involved internally in a process in looking at our and when it comes to psychiatric residential treatment facilities, which is a subset of the groups that have been represented here this morning, And we have looked at the multiple parts of within DHS and their roles and responsibilities and how they've actually, how we go out and conduct reviews. And we are looking, we've completed our process mapping for that, and then our next step is to then bring in the partners to, one is look at the process map and then get their input into that. We do see some opportunities for some consolidation of some of the activities and some also just some coordination and collaboration to minimize the impact on providers as they prepare for multiple reviews. And so so we are very open and very interested in discussions with providers regarding this particular issue, and we are currently involved in that. Our only issue with this bill and even the amendments is we're willing to do this, and we're starting some of the process, and the question is whether this requires a legislative bill. So that was.
Thank you, Michael. Any questions of this witness? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was going to be my question, is do we need to do this in statute? You're already doing it, or you're going to already be doing it?
Chair Tomei and Representative Boone, we are currently in a process for at least one segment of it, and we are very open to expanding that discussion to look at other areas and very interested in looking at suggestions that they have for consolidation and streamlining.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I appreciate your effort and want to look at these efficiencies. I'm kind of interested in how we got to where we are. I mean, it seems like we have all these different regulatory things. Are those just over time have kind of been created in a way that we didn't coordinate? Or, and I'm only asking the question so we don't continue to do that from up here by having new legislation pushed through that requires oversight.
Sure. Chair Tomei and Representative Freeman, possibly some of it has been over time and the layering of different regulations. However, some of it has to do with funding sources and being responding to various contracts, DHS responding to federal requirements with Medicaid, for example, and the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services regarding seclusion restraint. So there are different things that have come along the way and have just probably be safe to say that they've been add-ons.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you. Is there any thought to, in the future, as new things come from wherever they come from, looking to see where you can plug them into oversight that's already being done and look for that efficiency right from the beginning?
Chair Tomei, Representative Freeman, I would support that, and I believe DHS would support that. I don't want to promise that at this point in time.
Thank you.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My concern is that we get mixed signals, unfortunately, from DHS that they only act when the legislature directs them to act. And sometimes they don't act when they don't get direction, and sometimes they act when they get direction. And so I would not want to leave this, you know, at the discretion of the department to look for it. I mean, particularly if this doesn't have a particular funding requirement, which would be a huge detriment at this point. It's obvious to me that, you know, something's not matching up when one state doesn't have to license an organization because they're nationally accredited, and Oregon says, well, we still have to license it before they can get accredited. There's a disconnect there. And those issues clearly need to be raised, because all they are is another layer of bureaucracy on top of each other. And most of it's our fault, quite frankly, that over time we add one little bill after one little bill, and it piles on. And we need to peel the onion and figure out who's the real customer, who's really benefiting, and get away from the pile-on effect, which we're good at.
I know you have a question, Representative. Michael, on the second page of your testimony, you mentioned that this residential program for adults, most programs are only regulated by one agency. Can you talk some about that in terms of one agency for adults and multiple agencies for children?
Chair Tomei, in regards to that, it has to do, to some degree, is that our adult residential programs, they're nearly their primary funding source is within addictions and mental health. And so there's not multiple funding sources having requirements on them. So it ends up being just the addictions and mental health division that is ends up being responsible for the licensing and certification in some cases within those programs. I would like to correct that. There is one other agency, Office of Investigations and Training, that even in adult residential programs in regards to abuse and neglect, they would investigate those separately.
Thank you, Michael. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think on a previous bill, my question was taken a little bit different direction than what my thoughts were when I made the question, so now I'm a little reticent to build on a couple of Representative Maurer's comments, but I'm going to anyway. You mentioned mixed messages, and I think that's what I'm struggling with here this morning, is we are getting a lot of mixed messages and trying to figure out how to deal with them. In a previous hearing, we've learned and heard a lot about safety and the need for more regulatory oversight and caution about how we protect children in agencies. And then today we're hearing about the challenges of multiple processes with regard to that oversight. And also the comment of one little bill after another, how much of this is the legislators' fault. Legislatures in the big picture fault, because we take each of these issues one little piece at a time and we try to come up with a law to make corrections. So I think my question is around, having babbled for a while, my question is around your comment that you said there is an interest in looking at the other agencies' suggestions. And you've also, I've heard comments about multiple funding sources, which I think is really the underlying driver of all of these various reporting systems. Could the agency come back to us with some commitment, short of a law perhaps, that would take these very valuable suggestions that I've heard here this morning, I've seen in written testimony, and to begin to struggle as part of that process that you're going through with how can we make it easier for entities that are doing good work to do the good work they're doing and still assure the safety of the residents that we're working with and try to streamline the whole thing so people could actually be working with the children they're supposed to be working with.
Chair Tomei and Representative Cowan, I would be happy to take that back to the Department of Human Services as well as probably some discussions with the Alliance to see what it is we could come back with in regards that would provide the right amount of assurances that we would be involved in that process and discussions.
Representative Booth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would be remiss if I didn't bring this up, and that is, I think I'm piggybacking on what Representative Cowan just mentioned, is last week we had hearings and we found out that there is a great need in one area in particular of children's programs for protection that doesn't have any right now. That's in preschools under 4 hours a day, and so I'm probably going to be submitting a priority bill to require something in that so we don't have to wait so long while the Commission on Children and Families studies that. But it seems amazing to me. Maybe we can take some of whatever you're going to efficiency-wise use here and apply it to that other area where there is absolutely no oversight right now by the department or anybody else. I had to say it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. A quick question, because I want to bring a witness back.
Okay,
so,
go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Wright, could you come back up, please? Thank you very much, Michael. Okay, actually, you can stay there. Could you remind us again what the Dash 2 amendments would do?
They suggest some areas where we are seeing particular themes of redundancies and oversight that we would like to take a look at. It puts a burden back on the provider community to come up with the recommendations, do the research, do the work, bring it to the department. And it does not require the department to act specifically on our recommendations, but to review them, acknowledge them, and report back.
Good. I just want to make sure I understood that. Thank you so much. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do find it interesting. I've mentioned a number of times here that I'm not a real fan of creating a statute to push an agency into doing a research project or study or use it as an outcome measurement for themselves. But in this case here with this bill, I like it, and I think it's a good idea. I mean, when I sit back and I listen to what Kim Scott has to say about what Trillium is, and I'm familiar with Trillium quite well, and what they've done is benefits there for children. I do not want to see obstacles get in the way, and I think this bill is a good movement toward that.
Okay, thank you. Any last comments, questions? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I'm sitting here thinking about this in terms of my experience, and I think the hardest part of all of this is seeing the big picture and who's in charge of seeing the big picture, because those people who are out in the field doing the work are advocates for their work, and you end up, if you're trying to see the big picture, trying to make everybody else see the big picture so that you limit these kinds of things that are going on. And I think, for me, the hardest part is the person who sees the big picture.
Thank you. Thank you, committee. Thank you very much for coming today. Thank all of you who came today to testify. Thank you, Representative Kinnemer. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3278. Any comments for the good of the order? All right. Thank you. I will close the House Committee.